Being gay can come in handy.
I can see that, says Stan. Maybe I need some of those gayness lessons. But we want the client to have an overall positive experience. We're all for gender equality. If the ladies want sex for cash, we provide it. Wait a minute, says Stan. Not you, says Rob. You'll just give us a call on the cell over at the Your Elf Nightline, and we send one of the Elvis bots. Big markup on those, like a super dildo, only with a body attached. Vibrator built in, optional. Wish I felt like that, says Pete. Then you chat with them, pour them a drink, tell them you wish you were straight. When the Elvis arrives, you switch him on, and he hums a little tune while you run over the instructions with the client. He responds to simple voice commands like, Love Me Tonight, Wooden Heart, and Jingle Bell Rock. The speed on that last one's edgy, but some of them like it. Then you wait in the lobby. You'll have an earpiece, so you can hear if it's unfolding as per plan. Oh, great, thinks Stan. Parked in a hotel lobby and eavesdropping while some mildewed hen has an orgasm. He's had enough of insatiable women. He remembers Charmaine, the way she was when they were first married. Her quasi-virginal restraint. He didn't appreciate it enough. Why wait in the lobby, he says. So you can supervise the re-delivery. Plus, in case there's a malfunction, says Rob. Right, says Stan. How will I know? If you hear too much screaming, time to act. Get up there fast and flip the off switch. It'll sound different, says Rob. The screaming, more terrified. No one wants to be fucked to death, says Pete.
Why suffer? Ed has still not returned to the office. All that's happened is that three men with positron logos on their jacket pockets arrive with a large crate. It's a stand-up desk, they say, and they have orders to install it in the office of the big boss. Once the desk is in, they go away, and Charmaine is left to her own devices, which consist of slipping off her shoes and stockings and painting her toenails, behind the desk in case anyone comes in. Blush pink is the color she's allowed. Nothing flaming, nothing flagrant, nothing fuchsia. Aurora bought the blush pink for her and presented it in that smug way she has. Here you are. This shade is very popular among the 12-year-olds, I'm told, so I'm sure it will convey the right message. Aurora gives a lot of thought to those details, which is helpful, but Charmaine can feel herself reaching the moment when she's going to yell. Darn it! Leave me alone! Stop talking at me! Something like that. Painting your toenails gives her a lift. That's what most men never understand. How it's a real pick-me-up to be able to change the color of your toes. Stan got mad at her once when they were living in the car because she spent some of her pixel dust tip money. He didn't say spend. He said fucking blue on a little bottle of polish in a lovely silvery coral shade. They had a tiff about that, because she said it was her money, she'd earned it herself, and it wasn't as if the polish cost a lot. And then he accused her of throwing it up to him that he didn't have a job. And then she said she was not throwing it up, she only wanted her toes to look nice for him. And he said he didn't give a fucking fuck about her fucking toe color. And then she cried. She has a little cry now, remembering it. How bad are things when you can get nostalgic about living in your car? But it isn't the car that makes her sad. It's the absence of Stan. And not knowing if he's mad at her. Really mad. Not just fucking fuck toe color mad. They're not the same thing at all. She tries not to think about Stan not being here anymore because what is, as Grandma Wynne used to say. And what can't be cured must be endured. And laugh and the world laughs with you, but cry and you cry alone. Maybe it serves her right for talking back to Stan that time in the car.
I'll teach you to talk back.
Now who said that? And how had she talked back? Did crying count as talking back? Yes, it did, because after that something bad happened.
Let that be a lesson to you.
But what was the lesson? She lets her mind go blank. Then after a while of staring at the map with red and orange pins all over it like measles, she thinks, Ed will need a lamp for that stand-up desk, which gives her the excuse to go to the Consilient's digital catalog. She browses here and there to find the right section, pausing maybe too long at ladies' fashions and cosmetic magic, and orders the appropriate lighting device. Then it's time to go home. So she does go home. Not that it's really a home, more of a mere house, because as Grandma Wynne said, it's love that makes a house a home. Sometimes she wishes Grandma Wynne would bug off out of her head. Aurora is ensconced on the living room sofa. She's having a cup of tea in a date square. Would Charmaine care to join her? She asks with her wide, tight smile. As if she's the darned hostess, thinks Charmaine, and I'm simply a visitor. But she passes over this because, what the hey, she has to get along with this woman, so she'll suck it up. No tea, thank you, she says. But I could really use a drink. I bet there's some olives or something in the fridge, too. There were olives last time she looked. But food has been appearing and disappearing out of that fridge like it has a bad case of gnomes. Certainly, says Aurora as Charmaine sinks into the easy chair, kicking off her shoes. There's a pause while each of them waits to see if the other one's going to get the drink. Darn it, thinks Charmaine. Why should I be her maid? If she wants to be the hostess here, let her darn well do it. After a moment, Aurora sets down her cup, pushes up from the sofa, takes the olives out of the fridge and puts them in an olive dish, then rummages among the liquor bottles. There are more of these than there used to be. Jocelyn has a special allowance. She's not limited the way the rest of them are, so it's her that's bringing in the booze. Consilience takes a dim view of drunks because they aren't productive. And they develop medical problems, and why should everyone pay because one individual has no self-control? That's been on the TV quite a lot recently. Charmaine wonders if there's bootlegging going on, or maybe people making moonshine out of potato peelings or something. Or more drinking because they're getting bored. Campari and soda? Says Aurora. What's that? Thinks Charmaine, some snobby drink unknown to us hicks. Whatever, she says, as long as it's got a kick to it. The drink is reddish and a little bitter, but after a few gulps of it, she feels better. Aurora waits until Charmaine's drunk half. Then she announces, I'm staying here this weekend. Jocelyn thought it would be best. I can keep an eye on you just in case anything unexpected happens. Oh, heck, Charmaine thinks. She's been looking forward to having some me time. She'd enjoy a long soak in the tub, in behind the shower curtain where the camera can't see her, and without having to worry about another person who might want to get in there to floss their teeth. Oh, I don't want to put you out, she says. I don't think anything unexpected. I'm fine, really. I don't need... I'm sure that's true, says Aurora in her tone that means the opposite. But think of it this way. What if he decides to pay you a visit? A big what if, thinks Charmaine. She doesn't need to ask who he is. But she doubts very much that he'll be visiting, since from what Jocelyn says, his dick is in a cast. I don't think he will, she says. Not this weekend. You never know, says Aurora. I understand he can be impetuous. Anyway, he'll be happy to hear you've had a chaperone. I also understand he can be quite jealous. And we wouldn't want any undue suspicions to arise. Would we? It's better than she thought it would be, the weekend with Aurora. You should never pass up the chance to learn something new. And Charmaine learns several things. First of all, she learns that Aurora can make good scrambled eggs. Second, she learns that Ed is planning some sort of a trip and that Charmaine will be invited on it, But Aurora doesn't know where or when, so right now it's only a heads up. And third, she learns that Aurora's face is not her original face. It's always been obvious that she's had work done. Charmaine has known that from the get-go. But what Aurora tells her goes way beyond mere work. "You may have wondered about my face," is how Aurora opens the face round. This is on the Sunday, after they've watched Some Like It Hot while eating popcorn and drinking beer. Not that Charmaine likes beer that much, but it seemed like the right thing to do. Then they got into the mixed drinks, which by this time are unusual since the ingredient options are running out. Now they're feeling like old best girlfriends from school. Or at least Charmaine is feeling like that. Not that she had any best girlfriends from school, not really close ones. When she was little, she wasn't allowed to have them. And then later she didn't want to have them because they would ask too much about her life. So maybe she's having a belated best girlfriend. Though it might just be the effect of her fourth Campari and soda, or is it a gin and tonic, or maybe something with vodka? "Your face? What do you mean?" says Charmaine, trying to sound as if she's never noticed anything wrong with it. "You don't have to pretend," says Aurora. "I know what I look like. I know it's too tight. But I used to look very different. And then for a while I didn't have any face at all."
"No face?" says Charmaine. "Everyone has a face."
"Mine got scraped off," says Aurora.
"You're kidding," says Charmaine. And then she can't help laughing because it's too ridiculous. A scraped off face. Like scraping icing off a cake. And then Aurora laughs too, as much as she can, considering.
"I was in a roller derby accident," she says when they're finished laughing. "It was a charity thing for the image consultant agency I was working for then. We were raising money for lung cancer. I guess I shouldn't have volunteered, but I really wanted to help out. You know."
"Oh, yes, I know. But roller skates, that's dangerous," says Charmaine. She wouldn't have spotted Aurora as being that athletic. Face scraped off. It hurts her to think about it. Aurora is looking blurry, and Charmaine can almost see underneath her skin. Hurt is what's under there. So much hurt. "Yes, I was young then. I thought I was tough. I shouldn't even say accident. It was a deliberate tripping by Maria in accounts. She had it in for me because of this man called Chet. Not that there was anything. And I landed right on my face at top speed. I came out looking like hamburger."
"Oh," says Charmaine, sobering up a little.
"Oh, terrible."
"I couldn't even sue," says Aurora. "There wasn't even a category."
"Of course not," says Charmaine sympathetically. "Darned insurance companies."
"So they offered me a full face transplant," says Aurora, "for signing up at Positron."
"They did?" says Charmaine. "You can do that with faces? Pop your face off and pop another one on? You could be a whole different person on the outside, not just on the inside."
"Yes, they were at the experimental stage, and there I was. I was custom made for them. They wanted to see if they could transplant an entire face. Why suffer is how they put it."
"Whose face did you get?" Charmaine asks. It's a tactless question. She shouldn't have asked it. The face of a procedure is the answer. The face of someone who didn't need their face anymore? But they'd have been blissed out or gone to glory while it was peeled off them. They wouldn't have known. And it was all for the best. The better. The good. She upends her drink.
"Those were early days. Aurora says. They're doing things differently now. Differently, says Charmaine. Things. You mean they're killing them differently, those prisoners? They're not doing the procedure? She shouldn't have blurted that out. She knows never to use the K-word. She's had too much to drink. At least she didn't say murdering. Killing is harsh, says Aurora. It was positioned as the alleviation of excessive pain. And happily, there are now more ways than one of doing that. Alleviating the excessive pain. Ways that are less harsh.
You mean they don't kill them?
Even to herself, Charmaine sounds like a 5-year-old. She's overdoing it on the dumb. Hardly at all anymore, says Aurora. The thing is, people get lonely. They want someone to love them. That can be arranged for anyone now, even if you look like something the cat coughed up. Why should anyone have to endure that kind of emotional damage? Lord knows I can identify with the whole solution, considering the way my face, this face is. You can imagine I haven't had much of a love life since that happened.
Poor you, says Charmaine. Of course, there can be a downside.
A downside to what? Says Aurora a little coldly.
Well, you know, to a love life. All of that, says Charmaine. She could tell Aurora about a few of her own downsides, but why dwell on the negative?
Not if the person is devoted, says Aurora. Not if they're fixated on you, only you. It can be done. They do it by changing the brain. It's like a magic love potion.
Oh, says Charmaine. That would be, what's the word? Amazing? Impossible? She's never felt she had a lot of choice with love, especially with the hopeless kind. The kind that was mostly sex. You loved someone in that way, and wham, you couldn't help yourself. It was like going down a water slide. You couldn't stop. Or that's how it was with Max. Maybe she'll never be able to feel anything like that again.
Jocelyn's promised me, says Aurora, if I helped her. She says I can have that done very soon now, once she's identified the right match. I've been waiting so long. But now, I could have a whole new life.
Her eyes tear up. Charmaine is almost envious. A whole new life. How can she herself get one of those?
Escort. You've snagged your first Elvis escort gig, Rob tells Stan at breakfast. Or at Stan's breakfast. It's more like lunch for Rob, but Stan slept in. They're both eating much the same thing, however, undifferentiated foodstuffs. Things that come already sliced, things in foil packages, things in jars. The Elvisorium is not a gourmet establishment. Stan pauses in mid-crackle. He has to stop gobbling Pringles. They'll make him fat. Where? He says. Woman here for that broadcaster convention, says Rob. Nab. She's television, or ex-television from the sound of it. Thought I ought to know who she was. She wants someone to take her to a show. Sounds harmless. Stan actually feels nervous. Performance anxiety, he tells himself. What's there to worry about? This isn't his real job, or the rest of his fucking life. So what exactly do I do? He says. What she's ordered up, says Rob. You don't even have to go through the dinner. It's just the show. You won't know about the sex till later in the evening. That can be an impulse buy. But remember to compliment them on their dress. Gaze into their eyes, all of that. At your elf, we're noted for our discreet attention to every detail. Okay, got it, says Stan. He goes for his usual stroll along the strip to quiet his nerves, poses for a few photos, collects a few dollars, and one fiver from a big spender from Illinois. When he gets back to the Elvisorium, Rob's still in the kitchen. Some guys were here looking for you, he says. They had your picture. What kind of guys? Says Stan. Four guys. They were bald. They had sunglasses. What did you tell them? Says Stan. Four bald guys with sunglasses. That sounds ominous. Jocelyn never mentioned anything like that, and neither did Budge or Veronica. His contact is supposed to be just one person. Has Ed traced the data leak to its source? Has he pulled off Jocelyn's fingernails to extract Stan's whereabouts from her? Are these guys Ed's heavies? He sees himself being yanked into a car, then tied to a chair in a vacant garage, having the crap smashed out of him, until he cries, "It's in the belt buckle!" Already he's sweating inside his Elvis carapace. Or sweating more than he was. I said they had the wrong address, said Rob. I didn't like the feel of them. What kind of picture? Stan asks. He gets himself a beer, gulps down half of it in one swig. Of me. You think it was taken here? If so, he's really in trouble. Nah, it was old, says Rob. You were standing on a beach with a hot blonde, with penguins on your shirt. Stan feels his stomach clench. It's his honeymoon pic. It has to be. The last time he saw a copy of that was at Possibilibots. It was beside Charmaine's head, and he himself had been deleted. Ed and the Project are calling the shots on this for sure. They've tracked him down. Fuck it, he thinks. I'm fucked. He figures it's better to stay in crowds. The bald thugs won't want to call attention to themselves while abducting him. So it's good he has a client for the evening. Her name is Lucinda Quant, which rings a distant bell. Didn't Charmaine used to watch a show this Lucinda did back when they were sleeping in their car? The first time he heard that name, he could imagine the locker room jokes it must have generated in Lucinda's teenaged years. He meets her at her hotel, as arranged. It's the Venetian one. The lobby is crammed with NAB convention-goers, still with their badges on. Some of them look as if they ought to be famous, or have been, once. The others, the scruffier-looking ones, are probably from radio. Lucinda Quant spots him before he spots her. "Are you my rent boy, Elvis?" she says. He peers down at her tag and growls.
"Why, yes, little lady."
"Not bad," says Lucinda Quant. She's about 50, or maybe 60. Stan can't tell because she's so tanned and wrinkly. She grabs Stan's arm, waves goodbye to a chattering group of her fellow broadcast journalists, and says, "Let's get out of this freak show." Stan hands her into a taxi, goes around to the other side, and slides in beside her. He gives her his best rubbery-lipped smile, which she doesn't return. She's skinny in the arms, teeth whitened, and covered with silver and turquoise ornaments. Her hair's dyed black, her eyebrows are drawn on with a pencil, and on her head she's wearing two little horns, like baby goat horns, orange in color.
"Good evening, ma'am," he says in his Elvis register. "I sure do admire those horns you got."
It's as good a way as any of starting social chat. She laughs the hoarse laugh of a long-time smoker.
"Got them here, from a street vendor," she says. "Supposed to be the horns of Nymph."
"Nymph?" says Stan.
"It's a nymphomaniac imp," says Lucinda Quant. "Some comic book manga thing. My grandkids know about it. They say it's all the rage."
"How old are they?" Stan asks politely.
8 and 10, says Lucinda. "They even know what nymphomaniac means. When I was their age, I didn't know which end of the lollipop to put in my mouth."
Is that an innuendo? Stan hopes not.
"Suck it up, Stan," he tells himself. "Be a man. Better still, be some other man."
Lucinda reeks of blue suede, an Elvis tribute scent Stan has inhaled a ton of lately. A lot of the old babes wear it. It must be sort of like cats rolling around on their dead owner's sweatshirts. It's weird to wear a perfume named after shoes, but what does he know?
The aroma, a little like cinnamon but with an undertone of leather preservative, wafts up from between Lucinda's breasts, the tops of which are on display in the plunged neckline of her scarlet, hibiscus-flowered dress. "So first I thought, those horns are for kids," says Lucinda. "But then I thought, why not? Go for it, gal. Live while you can, is what I say. I'm going to tell you right now this isn't my real hair. It's a wig. I'm a cancer survivor, or I am so far, touch wood. And right now I just want to enjoy the hell out of life." "Well, that's okay. These aren't my real lips," says Stan. And Lucinda laughs again. "You're fabulous," she says. She slides over and positions one of her bony little butt cheeks up against his thigh. Should he say, in his deep Elvis voice, "Whoa, darling, we've got all night?" No, that would hint unfairly of delights to come. Instead, he says, "So, since you've shared with me, I feel I should tell you that I'm gay." She laughs her smoky laugh. "No, you're not," she says. She pats his white-clad knee. "But good try. We can discuss that later." Here they are at the venue, in the nick of time. The casino is a new one, with a Russian Empire theme. It's called the Kremlin. Gold onion domes on the outside, servitors in red boots, a line of fire-eaters dressed as Cossacks waiting to welcome them. One of these helps Lucinda out of the car while raising his flaming torch high in the other hand. White Russians featured at the bars, and dancers in faux fur pasties bumping to Slavic rock on several of the gambling tables. Four theaters inside. The shows now pull in more than the gambling, according to Rob, though they make you walk through the gambling on the off chance you'll be seized by the devil of risk. "This way," says Lucinda. "I've been here before." She steers him toward the theater where their show will shortly begin. Stan keeps an eye out for any bald guys with sunglasses, but so far, so good. They make it past the slots and the blackjack and the table dancers without mishap, then into the auditorium. He settles Lucinda into her seat. She puts on her rhinestone-studded reading glasses and peers at the souvenir program. Stan glances around, locates the exits in case he has to run. There are at least a dozen other Elvises present in the auditorium, each with a crone under his wing. There's also a scattering of Marilyns in red dresses and silver blonde wigs, paired with elderly dudes. Some of them have their arms around the shoulders of their Marilyns. The Marilyns are throwing back their heads, doing the iconic open-mouthed laugh, flashing their Marilyn teeth. He has to admit it's sexy, that laugh, even though he knows how fake it is. "Now we'll make some conversation," says Lucinda Quant. "How did you get into this business?" Her voice has the neutrality and edge of a professional interviewer, which is what she claims to be. "Watch it, Stan," he tells himself. "Remember those four bald guys. Too many questions means danger."
"It's a long story," he says. "I just do this when I'm between engagements. I'm an actor, really, in musical comedy."
That's a surefire yawner. Everyone here is. Luckily for him, the show begins.
Requisition. Early on the Monday morning, Jocelyn comes over to the house. Charmaine's had a shower and is dressed for work, with a white frilly blouse and all. But she isn't feeling up to scratch. It must be a hangover, though she's had so few of those in her life she isn't sure. Aurora is making scrambled eggs and coffee, even though Charmaine has said she doesn't think she could look an egg in the face. She has a dim memory of what they discussed the night before. She wishes she could recall more of it. "There's an update," says Jocelyn. "Coffee?" says Aurora. "Thanks," says Jocelyn. She inspects Charmaine. "What's happened? You look like hell, if you don't mind my saying so." "It's the grief," Aurora says, and she and Charmaine both giggle. Jocelyn takes this in. "Okay, Good story. Stick to it if he asks, she says. I can see that the two of you had a play date in the liquor cabinet. I'll get rid of the evidence for you. Empties are my thing. Now, listen up. They sit at the kitchen table. Charmaine tries a sip of coffee. She's not ready to tackle the eggs yet. Here's his plan, says Jocelyn. Charmaine, he'll tell you he's taking a business trip to Las Vegas. He'll ask you to book tickets for him and for yourself as well. He'll say he requires your services on site.
What kind of services?
Charmaine asks nervously.
Is he going to trap me in a hotel room and then...
Nothing so simple, says Jocelyn. As you know, he's through with sex bots for his personal use. He's moving to the next frontier. This is what I was telling you, says Aurora, last night.
Charmaine's recollections of last night are a little fuzzy. No, they are very fuzzy. What was it she and Aurora were drinking? Maybe there was a drug in it.
There was something about Aurora's face coming off,
but that can't be right. Frontier? She says. All she can think of is Western movies.
Jocelyn brings out her posipad, turns it on, calls up a video. Sorry for the quality, she says, but you can hear quite well. There's a pixelated Ed standing in front of a large boardroom touchscreen that says Possibilibots in writing that scrawls across the space, explodes into fireworks, then begins again. He's addressing a small gathering of men in suits, visible only as the backs of heads.
I have it on good authority,
he's saying in his most persuasive manner,
that the interface experience, even with our most advanced models, is and can only ever be an unconvincing substitute for the real thing. A resort for the desperate, perhaps.
Here there's some laughter from the backs of the heads.
But surely we can do better than that.
Murmuring, the haircuts nod. Ed continues.
The human body is complex, my friends. More complex than we can hope to duplicate with what is and can only be a mechanical contrivance. And the human body is driven by the human brain, which is the most sophisticated, the most intricate construct in the known universe. We've been killing ourselves trying to approximate that body-brain combo, but maybe we got hold of the wrong end of the stick. How do you mean? Asks one of the heads. What I mean is, why build a self-standing device when a self-standing device already exists? Why reinvent the wheel? Why not just make those wheels roll where we want them to? In a way that is beneficial to all. The greatest possible happiness of the greatest possible number. That's what Possibilibots stands for. Am I right? Cut to the chase, says one of the haircuts. You're not on TV. We don't need the sermon. What's wrong with our current position? I thought we were raking it in, says another. We are, says Ed. But we can rake it in even more. Okay, short form. Why not take an existing body and brain and, by a painless intervention, cause that entity, that person, not to put too fine a point on it, that hot babe who won't come across for you, cause her to home in on you and you alone, as if she thinks you're the sexiest hunk she's ever seen? Is this some kind of perfume? Says another voice. With the pheromones, like with moths. I tried that. It's crap. I attracted a raccoon. No shit. A real raccoon or just a dame with... If it's a new oxytocin Viagra pill, they don't last. The next morning she'll go back to thinking you're a douche. What happened with the raccoon? That would be something new.
Laughter.
No, no, says Ed. Let's settle down. It's not a pill, and believe it or not, it isn't science fiction.
The technique they're refining at our Las Vegas clinic is based on the work that's been done on the erasure of painful memories in vets, child abuse survivors, and so forth. They discovered that not only can they pinpoint various fears and negative associations in the brain and then excise them, but they can also wipe out your previous love object and imprint you with a different one. The camera moves to a very pretty woman in a hospital bed. She's asleep. Then her eyes open, move sideways. "Oh," she says, smiling with joy. "You're here, at last. I love you."
"Wow, that simple," says a haircut. "She's not acting?" "No," says Ed. "This is one that didn't work out. We tried it on site here, but it was too soon. The technique hadn't been perfected. Our Vegas team is up to speed on it now. But it illustrates the principle."
Segway left. The woman is pressing her lips to a blue teddy bear in a passionate kiss. "That's Veronica!" Charmaine almost shrieks. "Oh my gosh! She's fallen in love with knitwear!"
"Wait," says Jocelyn. "There's more."
"I don't know what saboteur gave her that bear," Ed says. "Trouble is, this thing works on anything with two eyes. The guy who ordered the hit, ordered the job, ordered the operation, was very annoyed when he turned up, but he was too late. She'd already imprinted. Timing is everything."
"This is dynamite," says one of the heads. "You could have a harem. You could have..."
"So you designate the target, you requisition it." "Into the van, then the plane," says Ed. "Off to the Vegas clinic, a quick needle, and then a whole new life." "Fan-fucking-tastic."
Jocelyn turns off the posipad. "That's it, in a nutshell," she says.
"You mean they're snatching them?" says Charmaine. "Out of their own lives? The women?"
"That's a blunt way of putting it," says Jocelyn. "Though not just women, it's a unisex thing." "Yes, that would be the idea." But the subject doesn't mind, because their previous love attachments have been nullified.
"So that's why Ed wants her to go on the business trip to Vegas?" says Aurora.
"He hasn't told me in so many words," says Jocelyn. "But it's a fair guess."
"You mean he wants to fix it so I don't love Stan anymore?"
Charmaine says. She hears her own voice. It's so sad. If that happened, Stan would become a stranger to her. Their whole past, their wedding, living in their car, everything they went through together. Maybe she'd remember it, but it wouldn't mean anything. It would be like listening to someone else, someone she doesn't even know. Someone boring.
"Yes, you wouldn't love Stan anymore. You'd love Ed instead," says Jocelyn. "You'd dote on him."
"This is like one of those love potions in the old fairy tale books at Grandma Wynn's," thinks Charmaine. "The kind where you get imprisoned by a toad prince. In those stories, you always got the true love back at the end, as long as you had a magic silver dress or something. But in real life, in this real life, the one Ed's planning for her, she'll be under some awful toad prince spell forever."
"That's horrible," Charmaine says. "I'll kill myself first."
"Maybe," says Jocelyn, "but you won't kill yourself after. You'll come to when the operation's over, and there will be Ed holding your hand and gazing into your eyes. And you'll take one look at him and throw your arms around him and say you'll love him forever. Then you'll beg him to make whatever sexual use of you he wants. And you'll mean that. Every single word. You'll never get enough of him. That's how this thing is supposed to work."
"Oh, gosh," says Charmaine. "But you can't let that happen to me.
No matter what I've... You can't let it happen to Stan.
You still care about Stan? Jocelyn says with interest. After everything?
Charmaine has a flash of Stan. How sweet he was, much of the time. How innocent he looked when he was sleeping, like a boy. How crushed he would be if she turned her back on him as if he'd never existed and took the arm of Ed and walked away. He would never, ever get over it. She can't help it. She begins to cry. Great big tears are rolling out of her eyes. She's gasping for breath. Aurora brings her a tissue, but doesn't go so far as to pat her shoulder.
At least he wants you, she says. Not just the robot of you. It's okay, Jocelyn says. Calm down. Ed has specified that I'm going with you. I'm your security. I'm your bodyguard. I'm supposed to keep you safe. She pauses to let this sink in, and I will keep you safe. I've got your back.
Part 13. Green Man. Green Man. The show Lucinda's got tickets for is the Green Man Group. They're a spinoff of the Blue Man Group, who've been going in Vegas for decades. Stan saw a spoof version of them on YouTube when he was still working at Dimple. There are also the Red Man Group, and the Orange Man Group, and the Pink Man Group, each with a different gimmick. With the Green Man Group, says the program, it's an eco theme. Sure enough, when the spots and floods go on, there's some fake vegetation with some fake birds in it, and when the first set of green men come bouncing out, they're not only bald and painted a shiny green, but also wearing foliage. Apart from the leaves, it's the same kind of tightly directed comedy, tech, and music show that Stan can remember watching online, or parts of it. Tricks with balloons that turn into flowers, munching up kale and spitting green goop out of their mouths, juggling onions, and a lot of drumming, plus a guy with a gong who's used as punctuation. No words. None of the men ever say anything, since the pretense is that they're mute. Once in a while, there's a bit of message. Birdsong, a sunrise on the big onstage screens, a flight of helium balloons with baby trees attached to them. But then the drums kick in again. All of a sudden, there's a tulip number, done to tiptoe through the tulips. At first, this makes Stan sit up straight. It's the password from his time at Possibilibots. It can't be a fucking coincidence. But as the number unfolds, he thinks, hold on, Stan. Yes, it can be a coincidence. A lot of things are. And considering the barefaced idiocy of what the green men are doing up there on the stage, it has to be. If it were a signal, what the fuck would they be expecting him to do in response? Run around screaming? Yell, take my belt buckle! Here's the flash drive! So, coincidence for sure. He leans back in the seat, watches the number. There are tulip-themed pyrotechnics, tulip manipulations, tulip transformations, tulips that catch fire, tulips that explode, tulips that grow out of a green man's ears. Stan has to admit it's expertly performed, and also funny. It's relaxing to see other guys making fools of themselves. But if they're doing it on purpose, maybe it doesn't count. Next up, a gong item. The one playing the gong is a clown of sorts. He gets a lot of laughs. But is there only one gong guy? The green men are like the Elvises. They're in identical costumes and hard to tell apart. Stan tries to follow the switches, but it's like watching a card sharp. The trick is done, you know it's a trick, but you can't catch them doing it. The second last number is an audience participation segment. Three innocents are hauled up on stage, dressed in waterproof outfits, asked to eat peculiar substances, and bombarded with green goo. Then there's a grand finale, with more drums, gongs, and things that light up. Then there's the curtain calls. The bald green guys are sweating. So, Rental Elvis, what's your verdict? Says Lucinda as the lights go up.
Good timing, says Stan.
That's it? Good timing? Says Lucinda. Men devote their lives to developing those skills, and that's all you can say? I bet you're a wow in bed.
Fuck you, thinks Stan. But I'd rather not. Ma'am, he says, ushering her down the aisle with a swirl of his blue cape. After you. Her orange horns are on crooked. They give her a rakish air, like a demon on holiday. Lucinda says she's headed for the ladies, and after that she expects Stan to take her to one of the bars in this joint and share a white Russian or two with him and tell her his life story. The night is young, so after they do that, they can do something else. She fully intends to get her money's worth, she tells him, with a grin, but also in the stern, slightly accusing voice of a high school teacher. One thing at a time, he thinks. He shepherds her to the ladies. As he's waiting for her outside, scanning the thinning crowd for anyone thuggish who looks too interested in him, one of the Marylands sidles up beside him.
Stan, she whispers. It's me, Veronica.
What took you so fucking long? He growls. There's some positron guys in sunglasses asking about me at the place where I'm living. You need to move me. Where's Budge? Where's Connor? Am I a small potato? If this crap I'm carrying is so shit hot, why isn't anyone coming to collect it?
Keep your voice down, she says. Nab's always crawling with eavesdroppers. Those broadcasters like to steal scoops and rat on each other to anyone listening. That could be bad for you.
I thought Jocelyn wanted to get the news out, says Stan.
It's the positioning, says Veronica. She needs to hold back until the exact right moment. Come with me. Hurry. We're going backstage.
What about my date? Stan says. Lucinda will raise hell if he vanishes. She's the hell-raising type.
Don't worry about that. We've got another Elvis. He'll take your place. She won't be able to tell you apart.
Stan doubts that. Lucinda's not stupid. But he follows Veronica down a side aisle and through the exit door at the front row of the theater. There's a corridor, a corner, some stairs. Then the stage door. She knocks on it. It's opened by a bald guy painted green, in a dark green suit and an earpiece. That way, he says. They thought of everything. Themed bouncers. Veronica hurries along a narrow corridor, Stan trailing. She's got the Maryland rear action down cold. Do they give classes in it? Sprain your ankle, then stuff your feet into the high heels? Veronica, he thinks mournfully, you are so fucking wasted on that bear. They pause in front of a closed dressing room door with a green star on it. The Green Man Group.
Wait in here, says Veronica. If anyone comes, say you're auditioning.
Who am I waiting for? Says Stan.
The contact, says Veronica. The handover. The one who will take your info to the press. If we're lucky, that is. You've still got the belt buckle.
What's this? Says Stan, indicating his large, ornate midsection adornment. Kinda hard to miss.
Nobody switched it on you? The buckle?
Why would they? Said Stan. It's crap silver. It's not real. Anyway, I slept with it under my pillow. Veronica shrugs her lovely Maryland shoulders.
Hope you're right, she says. It wouldn't be good if they open it up and they're expecting a flash drive and there's nothing inside. They'll think you flogged it.
Who the fuck would I flog it to? Stan asks. He'd considered such a thing briefly, but he has no leverage. Whoever wanted it and knew where it was would simply take it, then fling him into a ditch.
Oh, someone would pay, says Veronica. One way or another. Now, in you go. I've got to run. Good luck.
She purses her Maryland lips, blows him a Maryland kiss, closes the door quietly behind herself. Nobody's in the dressing room. There's a long, lighted mirror, a counter running along underneath it, a bunch of makeup pots, green paint in them, brushes, a chair to sit in while painting yourself, a couple of green man suits on hangers, on the hook in back of the door. Street clothes, denim pants, jacket, black tee, pair of Nikes, large. Whoever's got this dressing room, his feet are bigger than Stan's. There's only one way out of this room. He doesn't like that part. He bypasses the chair and sits down on the counter, facing away from the mirror. He's careful not to turn his back to the door. Gong for hire. There's a knock.
What should he do?
Nowhere to hide, so he might as well go down trying.
Come on in, he says, using his Elvis voice.
The door opens. It's Lucinda Quant.
Fuck! How did she track him down?
But she doesn't say, where did you get to, or anything like that. Instead, she nips inside, closes the door, strides over to him, and hisses,
undo your belt!
She's fumbling at him with her red-tipped fingers.
Whoa, he says. Wait a minute, lady. If that's what you want, you need to be back at your hotel. And then I can call. We have a service. You'll love...
The thought of Lucinda Quant in bed with an Elvis bot makes him shudder. Even in her present diminished form, she'd be odds on to win that one.
Don't panic. I don't want your body, she growls with a derisive laugh. I want your belt buckle, right now.
Wait, he says.
She can't be the one. She's not at all what he was expecting. Not a suave double agent in black. Not a tough surveillance guy working for Jocelyn. Not, worst case, a positron-sent assassin. How can he know this unlikely biddy is the right handover link?
Just a minute, he says. Who sent you?
Don't be silly. You know who,
she says, tossing her black wig and orange nymph horns with a hint of the coyness that must have made her a lethal flirt 40 years ago.
This is going to be my fucking comeback, so don't screw around.
Wait, wait, he tells himself. You can't just roll over.
There's a password, he says as sternly as he can.
Tiptoe through the fucking tulips, she says. Now, do I have to pull your pants off or what?
Stan unsnaps his belt. Lucinda takes it over to the makeup counter, puts on her reading glasses, and holds the buckle under the light. She's got a tiny implement, like a little screwdriver. She inserts it into the top of the buckle, gives a twist, and the thing snaps open. Inside, there's a miniature black flash drive. She tucks the drive into a small envelope, licks it shut, whips off her hair complete with the horns, and duct tapes the drive to the top of her fuzzy scalp, which isn't totally bald, but close. Then she pulls the wig back on and adjusts her horns.
Thanks, she says. I'm off. I sure hope this has a major scandal in it. I don't mind risking what's left of my neck, so long as it's worth it. Watch the news.
She's gone in a swirl of hibiscus floral print and blue suede perfume.
What's next? Stan wonders.
Wait until the four guys in sunglasses arrive and start ripping out my molars?
I don't have it, he'll scream. It's that wizened-up cancer survivor with horns. She's duct-taped it to her head.
Why can't life hand him something plausible for a change? The door opens again. Four bald guys file in, except they don't have sunglasses, and they're green. They fill the dressing room.
Stan, says the first one, advancing in back-pat stance. Welcome to Vegas, bro.
Connor, says Stan. What the fuck?
They do the pat. Something wet comes off on Stan's cheek.
Right, says Connor, smiling greenly. You remember Ricky and Gerald. It was Gerald let you in backstage.
Handshakes, grins, whacks on the shoulder. The fourth guy says,
Stan, well done.
Could it be Budge? Bald and green?
Yes, it could.
You guys freaked me out, says Stan. Turning up at the Elvis place with my picture and all?
His honeymoon photo on the beach, the one he'd sent to Connor. That's where they'd got it.
Sorry about that, says Con. Thought we could cut some corners, make contact earlier, save time. But we missed you.
It came out okay in the wash, says Budge.
How'd you get out of Possibilibots? Stan asks him.
In a box, like you, says Budge. Hard to find an Elvis outfit my size, but we cut it up the back the way the Undertakers do. Plus the box was cramped. But apart from that, it worked without a hitch. Our mutual lady friend closed my lid at the Possibilibots end.
Let's get you out of that dickwit Elvis trash. You look like a twat, says Connor. Who's got the razor?
Stan, wearing a badly fitting green man suit, his head newly shaved, his face a seaweed green, is drinking a coconut water in Connor's dressing room. Connor says the coconut water is a quick energy lift, though Stan really doesn't need any more energy right now. He's buzzing like a bad fuse. On the small, blurry dressing room screen, the second Green Man show of the night is in progress. They run them through in teams, says Connor, because the act takes so much out of you. Not out of his boys, because they're not really in it. They're just in disguise. They can come and go backstage because everyone in Team 1 thinks they're in the other team and vice versa. But Connor himself has always craved the spotlight, so he's had himself inserted as a gong player.
Yeah, I know, it's moronic, says Connor. But you have to admit it's the best cover while we're waiting to pull the job.
What job? Says Stan.
Oh, she didn't tell you?
She was extra fucking definite about you. She said you totally had to be in with us. Otherwise, it would be a fail. She said you were the linchpin.
Who says? You mean...
He stops himself from saying Jocelyn's name. He glances around, then up at the ceiling. Is it safe in here?
I mean her, the big wazooka. She said the two of you were fucking joined at the hip.
The big wazooka isn't how Stan would have thought of Jocelyn, but it kind of fits.
Bazooka.
So I'm the linchpin, he says. Mind if I ask why?
Fucked if I know, says Connor cheerfully. Been doing odd jobs for her since before Christ. She's known you were my big brother ever since she saw you at the trailer joint, before you signed in to that body parts wholesaler corral. But I never ask her why she wants what she wants. That's her business. Deal is, I just do the job, no loose ends. Then I collect, end of story, have a nice life. But I guess we find out tomorrow about why you're so fucking central. That's when it's going down.
Stan tries to look wise. Is it possible to look wise with your face painted green? He doubts it.
What do I do?
He says. He hopes they aren't going to rob a bank or kill anyone. On this job, when it's going down.
Figure we'll put you on the gong, says Connor. Not hard to pick up. Just have to know the cues, then hit the gong with the hammer and look like a dumbass. That shouldn't be too hard for you.
So I'm on stage? Says Stan. That's not safe. Everyone will be looking at him. But then, so what? He no longer has the thing in the belt buckle. He no longer has even the belt, since Ricky took away his whole Elvis outfit and tossed it into a dumpster.
Not here, says Connor. Place called Ruby Slippers. It's a retirement home clinic type of thing. A lot of rich old farts warehoused or getting themselves cut and sewed. We're the entertainment.
That's all, says Stan. All I have to do is hit the gong? Though he's been to that Ruby Slippers branch as Elvis a lot, romancing old ladies, nobody will recognize him, not in his current disguise as a giant pea.
Don't be a fucking dummy, says Connor. That's the cover. The real job is a snatch.
That place has fucking tight security, says Stan.
Hey, this is your brother you're talking to, says Connor.
He rubs two fingers together.
Those guys get paid off. We just go there, start the green act, knock down the security for the look of it, do the snatch.
Crap, thinks Stan. They're kidnapping someone. That could get them shot. Not to mention himself.
So I hit the gong. You got it, says Connor. And then, Wisco.
Wisco?
The big snatcheroonie, says Connor. It's genius.
In flight. Ed's up front, in business. It would look strange for Charmaine to be there, too. After all, she's only the assistant, officially. That's Ed's reasoning, says Jocelyn. He doesn't want to call undue attention.